Now on News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
The Saturday Morning Update.
Good morning. It is the Saturday Morning Update. I'm Rick Fowler, Jeff Wolf behind the console, Jane Houghton, our producer this morning. And, of course, the big story of the week, the indictment of former President Trump. And we will cover that from a number of different angles this morning. We've got our team of experts, Cheryl Atkinson, Jim Trusty. We've got K.T. McFarland coming up, Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer, John Gizzi, Jennifer Harper from the Washington Times. Now, the big story, I'm sure you've heard it. You may have heard the details, but a quick recap, and then we'll get into some of the real meat of it with some of the legal experts. But first off, President Trump reportedly facing 30 counts. Now, this is from a source to CNN. It has not been officially announced that it is 30 counts or 34 counts, a number you may have heard. Former president expected to be arraigned in Manhattan criminal court on Tuesday at 2:15. Timing of the appearance, though, does remain fluid. And, of course, negotiations ongoing with the Secret Service and the NYPD in New York to arrange for that arraignment. Now, the investigation actually began when Trump was still in the White House. And by now, I'm sure you know, it relates to the $130,000 payment made by Michael Cohen, who was Trump's personal attorney at the time, that payment made to Stormy Daniels in late October of 2016. So I want to get into some of the detail, and we will have Jonathan Turley kind of lead it off here. And he kind of lays out the situation as it stands now, because there's so many questions about the merits of the case. And here's how Jonathan Turley lays it out.
We don't know what is in this indictment. We have bits and pieces that have been leaked. The only crime that's been discussed for months is this thing I call a bootstrap crime, which is this misdemeanor that essentially Brad's trying to zap back into life because if this thing expired with a two-year statute of limitations. So the theory is that you can sort of make it live again by turning it into a felony and connecting it to a federal crime. But that federal crime, the election violation, first of all, it does not appear to be an actual violation, but it's also a charge that the Department of Justice declined to bring and Brad's own predecessor declined to bring. Part of the reason this looks so political is how this history unfolded, how it got here, and including the fact that Brad ran on a pledge that he was going to bag Trump.
And he went into some further detail, and then we'll get to Trey Gowdy, and we'll get to one of the other Trump attorneys as well.
First of all, even if you get past this serious statute of limitations problem, if they're using this bootstrap claim, you have to get by the fact that most of us don't believe this New York law was designed for this, to actually litigate effectively a federal crime that wasn't charged. But even if you get beyond that, the federal election violation itself was rejected by an FEC commissioner, was rejected by the Department of Justice in the sense that they didn't charge it. So this thing has layers of problems. And the question is why? Why would Bragg work so hard to try to bring out this misdemeanor and turn it into a felony? And the answer does appear to be politics. He fulfilled Trump's narrative with this case. Of all of the cases that could be charged first, this is the one Trump would want.
Now, you've heard a lot of talk about the number of counts that could be waged against President Trump in the arraignment. And the number that has been tossed around is 34. Trey Gowdy, of course, former congressman, and he is an attorney, and he helps to clarify what that number of counts could mean.
I don't know if it's 34 independent fact patterns or if it's like 34 bad checks written on the same day. I don't know if they're just counting or stacking the counts of the indictment. You have statute of limitations problems. You have real legal issues with this indictment. My concern as a former prosecutor is you're supposed to lead with your best set of facts, your best case. This, to me, is by far the weakest of the four investigations that the president is facing. It is the wrong prosecutor bringing the wrong case.
When you look at this, you think about all of the things going on in New York, and you think about Alvin Bragg, the district attorney in New York, the crime in New York, the violence, people being pushed onto subway tracks, elderly people attacked in the streets, and for the attention that is being paid by New York DA Alvin Bragg, his staff, the number of hours that are going into this to focus on what is was based on a misdemeanor is somewhat mind-boggling to me, and I'm sure it's mind-boggling to a lot of people. Interesting note here from Reince Priebus, and you know, Reince was the head of the Republican National Committee, but he was also general counsel at the RNC. And a lot of talk about the misdemeanors here of some payments that were miscoded on the books, misrepresented on the books, and those are misdemeanors in New York. Do point out that hush payments are not illegal in New York. So the payment alone is not a problem. It's the way it was recorded. And the idea is to try and elevate it to a campaign violation, because by paying the hush money and Stormy Daniels remaining quiet, it may have had some impact on the election. So that's part of the case that Alvin Bragg is going to make. But here's Reince Priebus, who dealt quite a bit with the Federal Election Committee when he was the RNC general counsel.
The FEC's already looked at this case. There was a complaint filed several years ago, and about 18 months ago, the Federal Election Commission decided that the Trump campaign did everything properly, and that, in fact, if the Democrats were correct, if their wish came true, and that the Trump campaign would have disclosed this on their campaign finance report, that would have been a violation and an actual misuse of campaign funds for personal use. And so the FEC said already that this case was dead in the water back in July of 2021. So the actual Federal Election Commission that governs the actual disclosure to the world and to the people of the United States has already ruled that there was no violation.
So that sums up the status with the FEC violation, at least from Reince Priebus' perspective. Now, you may have heard that President Trump has been very active on social media. He's obviously really angry about all of this, and he did put out a tweet on Truth Social where he said he thinks that the judge who will get this case hates him. Caitlin Collins at CNN asked Tim Pallottori. Now, he's one of the January 6th attorneys for former President Trump. Caitlin Collins asked him about the judge last night on CNN.
It sounds like you think this judge will actually be fair and does not hate Trump, as he said.
I wouldn't say that. I mean, I tried a case in front of him a few years ago that had different political implications. I don't know what he would specifically, you know, what his specific views on, you know, this client would be. But, you know, he's tough. You know, he was definitely not easy on us in that case. I did win. But the law on these types of things, whether it's the campaign finance issue or the intent to defraud that is within the business records falsification statutes, are things that there is pretty significant case law on, controlling case law from the New York Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court. So I think that he would be very hard-pressed to ignore that precedent and allow this case to go forward in light of that.
Now, you've heard reaction from both sides of the aisle. Of course, the Republicans, Mike Pence, the former vice president, saying it's outrageous. And pretty much all of the Republicans are attacking the indictment. And pretty much all of the Democrats are solidly behind the indictment. Basically, you could sum up the Democrats' response, book 'em, Dano, which is the way they feel about it. But I have one response here, and I think it's interesting because Peter Meyer is a former Republican congressman from Michigan. He voted to impeach President Trump, and he lost in the primary after he did vote to impeach President Trump. But this was his response also last night on CNN.
People have an opinion on him. Nobody is indifferent to him. Folks love him. They hate him. But the important point to remember about this issue is it's not about Donald Trump. It is about the idea of whether or not we should have a higher threshold for folks who are members of or who are former presidents. Should we be treating them We should, certainly shouldn't be treating them above the law, right? Nobody should be above the law. But that question of whether or not this individual is also below the law, setting aside the salacious elements of this case, setting aside the fact that we're talking about allegedly hush money to a porn star for an affair, right? That is salacious, but we're not talking about whether or not he's morally culpable.
For somebody that lost his seat over his impeachment vote, I thought that was a very interesting analysis from Peter Meyer, the former Republican Michigan congressman. One of the questions swirling around out there is, might the former president take a plea deal if this gets intense? Joe Tacopina is his current attorney on the New York case.
President Trump will not take a plea deal in this case. It's not going to happen. There's no crime. I don't know if it's going to make the trial because we have substantial legal challenges that we have to front before we get to that point.
Well, it is 6:19 on the Saturday morning update. And again, we'll have a number of different perspectives on this throughout the morning on the Saturday morning update. So stick around with us. Jennifer Harper, Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer, Cheryl Atkinson, John Gizzi, Jim Trusty, and KT McFarland all are on the way this morning. Coming up next, we've got an interesting interview. We're going to change it up a little bit. With everything going on, communication is really important and how we individually deal with communication. So we've got an interesting interview up next, but first, we're going to head over to the WMAL Traffic Center, and Mike Franciotti is there this morning.
In Virginia, still have the accident along the outer loop in the area of the Springfield Interchange. Two right lanes are blocked. You've got a brief delay there. Once beyond that point on the outer loop, as you move over toward the Woodrow Wilson Bridge, you're looking good. Into Maryland, Allentown Road, still shut down in both directions near Leon Street. This is near Joint Base Andrews. Lanes in both directions blocked off of this now long-standing crash. Beltway traffic moving well in Maryland, and no issues at this time on Interstate 95 between the beltways. Now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Storm Watch 7 forecast.
Tracking early morning rain and a few claps of thunder out there for your Saturday, but temperatures will start to warm into the 70s due to the very windy southwest winds. That will start to pick up right around your lunchtime. I expect those gusts to reach 49 to even 55 miles per hour between 5 and 8 p.m. as the main boundary pushes through. That could also bring a slight chance for a few showers later this evening as well. Winds stay breezy overnight, but then tomorrow they start to back off. Temperatures cooler in the 50s. I'm 7 News meteorologist Jordan Evans in the First Alert Weather Center.
63 degrees in the nation's capital, 6:21 on the Saturday morning update.
News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
Making sense of the news.
The Saturday morning update continues on WMAL. I'm Rick Fowler. Let us take a moment and step back. When was the last time you thought about your communication skills? Whether it's in a relationship, handling a family dinner if it turns to politics, or, of course, in the workplace. Well, there's a new book out this week, the title, Breaking Through, Communicating to Open Minds, Move Hearts, and Change the World. It is authored by Sally Sussman. She is Executive Vice President and Chief Corporate Affairs Officer at Pfizer. She's also the Vice Chair of the Pfizer Foundation. Sally, it's great to have you with us.
Oh, thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
What really prompted you to write Breaking Through? And what do you think people can do to improve how they communicate to open minds, move hearts, and change the world?
Well, thank you. These are ideas and professional principles that I've been honing for decades in my time in government in Washington, always thinking about how can people be more impactful, clearer, better communicators. It was during the pandemic, however, that my ideas crystallized, because here at Pfizer, I was under pressure to be able to explain to a frightened and nervous public what we were doing and how we were doing it and the urgency and care with which we were bringing vaccine with a novel mechanism. So I thought about these ideas for decades, but I wrote this book over the last couple of years.
So we're in Washington. When you look at cancel culture, you write in the book, when cancel culture fever rises, no one is safe. So today we all see how people have become adamant about what they consider to be right and wrong, and often we don't agree. So how do we use grace, kindness, whatever strategies you can recommend, what do we use to kind of, you know, bridge the gap?
Yeah, in the polling data that I see and what you reference in Washington and across the country is a very polarized public, and one in which we even see polling data that says someone wouldn't help another person if they were in a struggle just because they disagreed with them. That's heartbreaking to me. What I'm advocating for, and it's the headline of my final chapter, is that we need to seek harmony. And if we could seek harmony, we would acknowledge that we're not going to win the point in every argument. You and me, we may not agree on everything, but that doesn't mean we can't disagree in a civil and respectful way. And some of the tools I share to go on that path, first and foremost, is to be a good listener and to listen for understanding, not listening to rebut or to make my next point against you. Another is to respect the other person and be open in your mind and your heart that there's a possibility that they just might be right on something. And being open to that possibility is important. I detail other suggestions and ideas for how to be in the world and communicate in the world so that we can at least get along and have a civil conversation.
And in general, when it comes to encounters with other people, you discuss several elements in the book that can help us connect with others more profoundly, not necessarily in sort of that adversarial situation with cancel culture, but just in general.
Yeah, and they sound simple, but they're not always simple. They're important. So, for example, be curious. Ask questions of another person. Be gracious. Start off on a positive note. Tell someone you're happy to have the chance to meet them. Be thankful. Follow up for the conversation that you had. And use humor. You know, we can't let cancel culture or the fear of it prevent us from being lighthearted with one another at times. That would also be tragic. So these are some of the sounding simple, but I believe truly profound tips that can help us to connect with one another and to, you know, as I say, open minds and move hearts. That's my goal.
Now, we've talked about personal relationships. What about the corporate community? Sometimes there's sort of a gap between the brands and the prospective customer. Any recommendations there?
Sure. I've spent most of my professional life in big companies, and I really have a pet peeve against corporate speak. You know, where you read something from a corporation and it's a lot of words, but it says nothing. Companies need to be more personal, more present, speak in real terms, not be cloistered behind big firewalls, and really just engaging with the public is so important, and doing it in a way that demonstrates the humanity of the people who are here, you know, is just very real, very personal, and again, avoiding all of those terrible cliches or acronyms or things that are alienating and make companies feel hard and unknowable.
In the book, you lay out 10 principles, and you go into great detail, but can you just give us a real quick rundown?
Sure. Here's the list. First, channel your intention. Second, muster the courage for candor. Next, stay curious, be creative. Consider the strength of being gracious and kind. Take time to pause and prepare. Next, perfect your pitch. Next, disarm with humility and empower with truth. Delight with humor. Reflect and honor. And the final one, seek harmony.
Sally Sussman, thank you so much for being with us. And where can people find out more about you and Breaking Through?
Please invite your listeners to check it out at www.sallysussman.com.
That's Sally Sussman, Sussman. Thank you so much, Sally. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
6:28, it is the Saturday morning update on WMAL. Coming up next, we'll talk with Jennifer Harper of the Washington Times, Jim Trusty on the way, and we're going to take a look at D.C. crime. Oh, stick around. Saturday morning update continues. I went to the Target Northwest Washington, Wisconsin Avenue, Tenleytown by American University. All of the detergent, all the laundry detergent is now locked up behind glass. You have to get assistance. Why? Because of the crime. People are stealing laundry detergent. It's a big thing now. Well, on Capitol Hill this week, there was a House hearing. Phil Mendelson is the chairman of the D.C. City Council, and he was grilled. And I want you to listen to the response of Phil Mendelson, and then we'll get to a former D.C. homicide detective.
The crime statistics alone are shocking. D.C. clearly has a crime crisis. The D.C. Council saw these rising crime trends, but rather than support policies to protect the residents, it did the opposite.
I know this belies the common belief, and when it comes to crime, how people feel is important, but there is not a crime crisis in Washington, D.C.
Now, I'm sure you have a response to that. I have a response to that, but I think the best response to that is from Ted Williams. He was on the Fox News Channel. He is a former D.C. police homicide detective, and you've seen him on Fox before.
You know, Jackie, I believe that that city official needs to get his head out of the sand. We have a crime crisis in the nation capital. This is a national embarrassment. And when you find out that the prosecutor, Matthew Graves, the U.S. attorney, will not prosecute at least 67% of those arrested, you have to question that. The chief of police, Robert Conti, a leader whose men and women go out there every day and put their lives on the line. They are making the arrests, but those arrests have to come before a prosecutor. And the prosecutor in the District of Columbia is declining to prosecute burglaries, drug crimes, or gun-related crimes. And just yesterday, we had the union president to testify that over a six-year period, the homicides have increased 75%. Wow. Armed carjackings have increased 227%. Armed robberies have increased 46%. Yes, there is a crisis in the District of Columbia.
In spite of what the chairman of the D.C. City Council says, Phil Mendelson. 6:33 Saturday morning update on WMAL. Mike Franciotti's in the WMAL Traffic Center.
In Virginia, the outer loop of the Beltway in the area of the Springfield Interchange still have the accident there. It looks like they may have moved it out of the travel portion of the roadway, and a brief delay past the scene there. No issues elsewhere on the Beltway in Virginia. The main lines of 395, Interstate 95 doing well. Of course, we've got many road closures in place already in the district to accommodate the Credit Union Cherry Blossom runs, which will get underway later this morning. In Maryland, Allentown Road still shut down near Leon Street, that in both directions. Now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Storm Watch 7 forecast.
Tracking early morning rain and a few claps of thunder out there for your Saturday, but temperatures will start to warm into the 70s due to the very windy southwest winds. That will start to pick up right around your lunchtime. I expect those gusts to reach 49 to even 55 miles per hour between 5 and 8 p.m. as the main boundary pushes through. That could also bring a slight chance for a few showers later this evening as well. Winds stay breezy overnight, but then tomorrow they start to back off. Temperatures cooler in the 50s. I'm 7 News meteorologist Jordan Evans in the First Alert Weather Center.
63 degrees in the nation's capital, 6:34 on the Saturday morning update.
News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
Making sense of the news.
The Saturday morning update continues. I'm Rick Fowler. Jennifer Harper is with us. She writes inside the Beltway at the Washington Times. Good morning.
Good morning, Rick.
Well, it's been an overload on the media obsession with former President Trump. In contrast, what are we hearing about the Biden family problems after the release of those bank records?
Yeah, well, this is an interesting situation, isn't it? And certainly we're going to have lots and lots of Trump coverage. And well, we'll have to see about the Biden coverage. I've got one of these great Media Research Center studies about the big three networks. That is, of course, ABC, NBC, and CBS. And here's what they say. This is directly from our friends there at the Media Research Center. They say that the big three networks are burying any scandals involving the Biden family. Yet, of course, they continue to cover all the investigations around former President Trump, and they always back up their claims there with numbers. So their study was done March 16th through March 30th. And they said over 14 days, ABC, NBC, and CBS filled their evening, morning, and Sunday roundtable shows with over 272 minutes of Trump investigation coverage. Now, that's 4 hours and 32 minutes plus 56 seconds in change. And in contrast, according to this study, they spent 0 seconds on the Biden family stories that we've been hearing of rumors about. And on average, network audiences saw almost 20 minutes per day of Trump investigation stories. And they say that NBC devoted the most amount of coverage to the Trump investigations, 1 hour and 41 minutes, followed by ABC at 1 hour, 39 minutes, and then CBS 1 hour and 12 minutes. But that's how predictable this is all getting. Anyway, that's a Media Research study about the big three networks.
We've seen poll after poll about Joe Biden's approval ratings and even his approval ratings among the Democrats. And what are you hearing is the latest on their desires to have him up on the ticket in 2024?
Oh, my gosh. Well, here's some more numbers for you so early in the morning. But according to this, the Biden presidency, well, once is enough. It kind of looks that way. Once is enough for a lot of people out there. And, of course, we don't know the answer completely yet, whether Mr. Biden has decided to run again or not. But this is coming from a Monmouth University poll, and I always pay attention to the academic polls out there. They try to be kind of middle of the road. And you kind of wonder if Mr. Biden might want to sit the next one out. Anyway, here's what the poll analysis says. 3 in 4 Democrats, 74%, have a favorable opinion of Joe Biden, and just 14% hold an unfavorable view. However, when asked when they want to see what should happen in 2024, if the choice was up to them, nearly half, 44%, would like Joe Biden to step aside so that someone else can run as a Democrat for president. Only 25% say their preference is for Mr. Biden to pursue a second term, while 30% are kind of, meh, I don't know yet, no preference either way. Again, this is coming from Monmouth University. They say Democrats appear to be saying they like the job Joe Biden has done, but maybe it's time for him to move on when his term is over. However, no top tier of candidates emerges when these voters were asked to name a preferred alternative. And let's remember, these are Democrats we're talking about here. Part of that could simply be the holding pattern that Democrats are in because Biden has signaled that he will, in fact, run. That's what they think at Monmouth University. That's actually coming from Patrick Murray. He's the director up there. And one more little bit from them. They went through who the possible rivals to President Biden might be. They came up with 16 of them, Rick, and they ranged from former President Barack Obama and Michelle Obama to Hillary Clinton, former Georgia legislator Stacey Abrams, California Governor Gavin Newsom, Senator Bernie Sanders, of course, is on there, and also Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg. So that's kind of play-by-play for Biden this morning.
Well, he hasn't done too well at the play-by-play at the southern border. What about the northern border?
Yeah, those border issues are always there, no matter what kind of coverage we have with Trump and everything else going on with China. The border issue was always there. You don't get a lot of media coverage here, but there was a little kind of a reality check this week when Andrew R. Arthur, he is a resident fellow in law and policy for the Center for Immigration Study, and he appeared before a House subcommittee, and the title of his hearing, Rick, kind of tells all. He says, Biden's growing border crisis, death, drugs, and disorder on the northern border. They're looking at the northern border, and you have to remember that that border is 5,525 miles long. And it separates 7 Canadian provinces and 13 U.S. States. I looked that one up myself. That's from NOAA. But anyway, Mr. Arthur, he notes that this border is rugged, isolated, and relatively unpopulated. He says, given the awesome length of the northern border, it is understaffed by any measure. And certainly when compared to the 1,954-mile U.S. southwestern border, which itself suffers from lots of lack of staffing and resources. But he gives us some numbers here. According to the latest statistics, there were 16,878 Border Patrol agents on the southern border, but only 2,019 along that northern border. So people are starting to kind of get worried here. And according to this study, again, this is coming from the Center for Immigration Studies. That was an interesting group. They say, already in just the first 5 months of fiscal year 2023, U.S. Border Patrol has encountered 68,784 illegal aliens at the northern border. They are from India, China, Colombia, Philippines, Haiti, Venezuela, Mexico, and Ukraine, among other nations, Rick. And so last but not least, our friend Andrew Arthur says, in my more than three decades of involvement in immigration and border security, both before and after September 11th, our borders have never been less secure. So something to think about.
Poll numbers out recently about how Americans feel about traditional values. What stood out to you?
Well, this is kind of a reassuring thing, and I paid attention to this poll because it comes from, believe it or not, the Wall Street Journal. And they asked the respondents in this poll to rank the importance of 10 different values, you know, kind of your personal values, kind of rank them, what's important to you, and they kind of offer some insights into what the way we're thinking today, even though we're overwhelmed by media and all sorts of crazy stuff. This is what they said. The most important value in the nation was hard work. That was cited by 94%, followed by self-fulfillment. 91% talked about that. Tolerance of others came third at 90%. Money was also tied for third at 90%. And community involvement at 80%. Patriotism, yay, was cited by 73%. That's three-quarters of the respondents there said patriotism was cited by them as the most important. Marriage by 70%. Belief in God and having children were both cited by 65% and religion by 60%. And surprisingly enough, 68% of them said that they were very or pretty happy. So I don't know. We'll have to think about that one, Rick. It's a Wall Street Journal poll, and that's what they found.
You know, there was a time when it was really tough and really expensive to get Washington football tickets, and baseball was a really nice alternative. You go out and it, you know, didn't cost you an arm and a leg. What's it looking like in 2023 as we go into baseball season?
Well, I have some numbers for you again. Good morning with the numbers. But this is very interesting because, you know, MLB season is now officially underway, and I did go to a game in D.C. not so long ago. It was really fun and interesting and a lot more. But anyway, if you do go to baseball games, you are probably pretty familiar with a lot of the ballpark prices. They can kind of be something to reckon with, you know, when you think about what you're getting there and what you eat and what you drink and so forth. And Axios.com, Axios is a very respectable media group, and they do a lot of studies also. And they did a check on the prices as we get underway in 2023 season. And these are based on games played by 30 U.S. teams in 2022. This is how much it costs to get in. And just kind of reality check here. And the estimates here are for four adult price tickets, pricing for the parking of one car, two hats for whatever fans you're traveling with, two beers, four soda pops, and four hot dogs. And the results, the Boston Red Sox had the highest price entry of all for a party of four, and that was $385.
Ouch.
Yeah, and the Arizona Diamondbacks were the cheapest of all at $152. Huh. And then let's just take a couple of looks here. It was a rather lengthy list, 30 teams on there. But anyway, New York Yankees, $349.
Oof.
Washington Nationals, $321.
Ouch.
Atlanta Braves, $256. Minnesota Twins, $227. Baltimore Orioles, $203. Pittsburgh Pirates, $199. And according to the analysis, they said no peanuts here. A breakdown of the typical cost to see a live Major League Baseball game last year puts the national average at $256. That was what it was last year. So it's kind of going up just like everything else. But still, good time. Cheerful crowd.
Jennifer Harper inside the ballpark. I mean inside the Beltway at the Washington Times. Thank you very much.
It's my pleasure. Have a good weekend, everybody.
6:46 Saturday morning update on WMAL. We'll talk to Jim Trusty next. First, Mike Franciati's in the WMAL Traffic Center.
In Maryland, Allentown Road still shut down in both directions in the area of Leon Street. That's by Joint Base Andrews. The accident investigation and cleanup continues. No problems on the Beltway in Maryland. Between the Beltways, take your pick. Both 95 and the Parkway moving well. No reported issues either direction along Route 50. Going into Virginia, the outer loop near the Springfield Interchange, that earlier accident is now gone. No problems on 395, the main lines of 95, Interstate 66, all moving well. Now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Storm Watch 7 forecast.
Tracking early morning rain and a few claps of thunder out there for your Saturday, but temperatures will start to warm in the 70s due to the very windy southwest winds. That will start to pick up right around your lunchtime. I expect those gusts to reach 49 to even 55 miles per hour between 5 and 8 p.m. as the main boundary pushes through. That could also bring a slight chance for a few showers later this evening as well. Winds stay breezy overnight, but then tomorrow they start to back off. Temperatures cooler in the 50s. I'm 7 News meteorologist Jordan Evans in the First Alert Weather Center.
63 degrees in the nation's capital, 6:47, the Saturday morning update.
News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
Making sense of the news.
The Saturday morning update continues. I'm Rick Fowler. Jim Trusty is with us. He is a member of the Trump legal team. He is a partner at IFRA Law here in Washington, and he is the former chief of the organized crime and gang section at the U.S. Department of Justice. Jim, good morning.
Good morning, Rick.
Jim, obviously the news this week of the Trump indictment from Alvin Bragg, the DA in New York. So many directions we could go on this. Many of them would be a discussion of speculation. So I want to kind of get away from that because there's so much we don't know at this point. And we'll leave that to the 24-hour day pundits on the cable news networks. What I wanted to ask you about first off is you are a former federal prosecutor. You've spent over two decades as a prosecutor. And I think a lot of people are commenting on the fact that Alvin Bragg, the district attorney in New York, bringing the charges, campaigned on the notion of getting Donald Trump. And this is just one quote from the New York Post. Alvin Bragg bringing an unprecedented criminal case against former President Trump after crowing on the campaign trail that he would be the best person to do it. I never thought that that was the role of prosecutors to make campaign promises to indict people.
No, it's the crossing of the Rubicon. You know, I've heard Mark Levin refer to it that way. It's a cultural seismic shift where if we don't shut this down, we've let this genie out of the bottle of political persecution, of going after people because of who they are. You know, I was a state prosecutor for a long time before I was a Fed. I had the benefit of very good bosses that really instilled, I think, very good judicial ethics in us as prosecutors. And that's kind of the key. A prosecutor, Rick, has to start off being judicious. They have to say, I am here to keep the community safe. I'm here to take on any individual case. I'm here to follow the evidence and take it where it leads me and then use my discretion appropriately. We entrust our prosecutors to do that, to seek justice in every case. And so it's the exact opposite of that. If you have a system where people can say, elect me and I will indict a political enemy. It doesn't really matter that it's Donald Trump right now. If we allow this to go as a new norm, as a new cultural phenomenon in the United States, we've completely changed rule of law. We've lost due process. We've lost the fairness that we trust prosecutors to have, and we've created just another politicized weapon for one-party rule. And you know, Letitia James said it. Alvin Bragg said it. I think the DA in Fulton County, Georgia, has said it. And it gets kind of passed on like it's a normal component of being a prosecutor when it's really the heart of unethical for them to approach any case this way.
Obviously, the spotlight is on Michael Cohen, former attorney to President Trump. There's a narrative in the media that Michael Cohen went to jail over those Stormy Daniels payments, and I've got an article here from Forbes magazine, April 21st, 2018, headline, Cohen pleads guilty to tax evasion, bank fraud, and campaign finance law violations. According to the plea, Cohen failed to report more than $4 million in income to the IRS, largely related to Cohen's work with various taxicab companies, many of which had been previously linked to tax trouble. Cohen was a partner in the taxi business for years. Cohen had also failed to report hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of income for other activities, including consulting and income from brokering sales of real estate and a Birkin bag, a hard-to-come-by French handbag. A lot more to that jail sentence than just campaign finance violations. Tell us a little bit about the whole role of Michael Cohen in this indictment.
Yeah, well, that's a great point. And look, the fact of the matter is, even if Michael Cohen had gone into court and pled guilty to conspiring in everything imaginable with Donald Trump, you know, the way the law works is one person's guilty plea is not evidence of anything for the next person. In fact, if you're in a trial and you have a cooperating defendant testifying against other defendants, the jury gets a specific instruction that, you know, Michael Cohen, in our example, pled guilty and admitted conduct that he did, but that is of no bearing. You cannot consider it as evidence of guilt against anybody else. So it's always a personalized decision. It doesn't have any spillover, no matter what the kind of mainstream media wants to make it sound like. But here's the more important thing about Cohen. I mean, Michael Cohen is essentially a convicted perjurer. He's a disbarred, failed lawyer, a felon. He has an axe to grind in terms of, you know, disliking President Trump. He's on TV even railing about how excited he is that the president's been indicted. But at the end of the day, he's not somebody anyone could ever build a case around. And that's the factual problem. It's really not about Stormy Daniels so much. It's really about Michael Cohen's complete lack of credibility as a basis for any sort of criminal charge. It's basically ludicrous. And as we understand it, at least from Bob Costello, an attorney who testified in the grand jury, Cohen specifically denied, apparently, having waived attorney-client privilege with his attorney, Mr. Costello. Now, Costello had represented him briefly and concluded he was a pathological liar, and he wrote notes that basically reflected that. So Costello went into the grand jury after Cohen had testified either once or twice. If Cohen said, I never waived attorney-client privilege, which it appears he did, Costello was a perfect devastating rebuttal when he went into the grand jury and said, here's the signed waiver that Michael Cohen signed about my attorney-client relationship. He literally proved that Cohen perjured himself yet again, this time in front of that same grand jury. So, you know, I don't know how the grand jury was instructed by Alvin Bragg's minions. I'm sure there's some real issues there. But at the end of the day, the only crime they should have contemplated indicting would have been Michael Cohen adding another perjury to his stack of misdeeds.
You brought up something interesting there. In a grand jury procedure, there's no defense attorney there per se. How strong a role does the prosecutor or can the prosecutor take in shaping the narrative with no defense there?
Yeah, it's literally an overwhelming role. I mean, this is why we talk about, you know, jokingly say a prosecutor can indict a ham sandwich, meaning the grand jury can basically just accept whatever the prosecutor presents and indict. And it is a lower standard of proof. We're talking about probable cause. We're not talking about proof beyond a reasonable doubt. The problem is when a prosecutor is a politicized prosecutor, when they're in the business of persecuting, then they really can't be trusted to present the law to the grand jury in any correct way. So there's no judge. There's no defense attorney. If a witness goes in the grand jury, the best they can do is have their lawyer out in the hall where they can consult them if they need to during the questioning. It's not an adversarial proceeding at all. It's an initial investigative stage. And historically, it made a lot of sense. And historically, grand juries showed a little more independence than they typically do now. But, again, one of the things that I'd expect in terms of early motions on behalf of President Trump, one of them may well be asking for an inspection of the minutes of the grand jury transcript. And what that means is, how did Alvin Bragg's attorneys advise them on the law? Because there are incredible legal frailties to how they're pursuing this case. And it'd be very interesting to see if they gave it to the grand jury straight or not. There's another thing I should just mention, Rick, which is the grand jury obligation of a prosecutor in New York is to actually provide exculpatory evidence. So in other words, if you have evidence that you're sitting on that shows that the defendant is not guilty, you have an obligation to share that with the grand jury. Again, when you're talking about political targeting, I have a hard time believing they kept up with their ethical responsibility.
You mentioned a possible motion to dismiss there. What other possible motions could there be?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think the listeners need to know that you generally don't win on a motion that's fighting over facts or credibility of a witness. So you wouldn't be able to file a motion, most likely, that says, please dismiss this case. Michael Cohen, you know, wouldn't know the truth if it bit him in the butt. You're not going to get anywhere with kind of assessing the credibility of the government's witnesses. So pretrial motions that relate to the dismissal of a case are going to be geared towards whether there's fundamental flaws in the indictment's legal theory. And most of the time, that's pretty avoidable. Most prosecutors are aware of the legal issues. They draft their indictments, you know, fairly tightly. They know where they're going, and they usually withstand that kind of initial scrutiny. But here you're talking about very novel theories of taking state misdemeanors, turning them into felonies by relying on federal offenses, which makes no sense in state court. There's no jurisdiction for that, for instance. Using that to extend the statute of limitations, which otherwise seems to have passed. And then even behind all of that is the problem of these particular record-keeping offenses, the misdemeanors, are based on the idea that you have an intent to defraud when you enter the false entry. And intent to defraud, not to get too in the weeds, but it's defined very particularly under New York law to mean essentially you are taking, depriving money or property from another person. Factually, that's not how this played out. Even under the dreamiest of Michael Cohen testimonies, it wasn't about getting money from somebody. It was about perhaps keeping someone quiet under a lawful non-disclosure agreement, but also referring to it in your own books in a very benign way or vanilla way. That may be deceptive, it may be wrong, it may be sloppy, but under New York law, that does not seem to fit the bill for these predicate misdemeanors. And so, again, if you have a fair judge and you file a motion on this in coming days or weeks, you could see a case cut short long before it would go to trial.
You know, I didn't want to really get into talking about speculation, but there is one note I think is significant. A leak to CNN has generated a media narrative that the indictment carries 34 counts. Now, we don't know that it does, but that's the speculation from an unnamed source. Is there a relationship of the number of counts in an indictment to the weight of the case?
No, not at all. In fact, it's kind of a Bush League prosecutor tactic sometimes to load up, to duplicate or triplicate the same facts in the multiple counts, in really kind of a desperate mode of hoping the jury thinks, well, there must be something to it because it's 50 pages long or it's 34 counts. I've seen state cases in New York where they've literally killed trees with the indictment. I mean, you know, hundreds of counts of an indictment. And then when you talk to the prosecutor and work out the plea agreement, your guy's pleading to one count. I think I saw RICO cases with gambling and with robbery and extortion. And had a client plead to a misdemeanor gambling charge. So, you know, there's nothing to it. It's for show. It's for press releases. It rarely reflects anything to do with the strength of the case. You know, and as I've told some friends, you know, would you rather have 34 littering counts or one count of first-degree murder? You know, it doesn't matter. If the counts are kind of garbage to start with, either legally or whether they can't be supported with credible witnesses, it doesn't matter if there's one or 100.
Jim Trusty, partner at IFRA Law. I know you've been very busy the last 36 hours. Thank you so much for taking the time this morning, Jim.
Sure. Happy to be with you.
Coming up on the 7 o'clock news, then we are back with John Gizzi, Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer, Cheryl Atkinson, and KT McFarland. Stay with us on the Saturday Morning Update.
WMAX.
WMAL-FM, Woodbridge, Washington, a Cumulus Media station.
Making sense of the news.
News Talk 105.9.